More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. For the past 6 months, we've been telling you the stories of Wisconsin soldiers fighting in the American Civil War through our Iron Brigade and Beyond series. Fighting with the brave regiments of the Iron Brigade to the old Abe 8th Battery B to the so-called Western Brigades, Wisconsinites saw action in some of the war's fiercest and deadliest battles. The voice of our series, historian Thomas Martin Sobotke, has taken us through charges at 1st and 2nd Bull Run, Shiloh, Groveton, South Mountain, Vicksburg, and the infamous Bloody Battle at Antietam. But there is yet one battle we haven't discussed that, for many, stands apart: Gettysburg. Its revered reputation stands for many reasons, among them its legacy as the deadliest battle in the Civil War and as a turning point for the Union forces. And Wisconsin soldiers were there, 6 infantry regiments, including those in the Iron Brigade, and a company of sharpshooters. We fast forward now to July 1, 1863, the first day of battle, and as Sobotke explains, the start of the Iron Brigade's last stand.
Oh, the Jubilee is coming, don't you sniff it in the air. And 63 is the Jubilee for free men everywhere. Oh, the Jubilee is coming, don't you sniff it in
the air. At Gettysburg, the role of the Iron Brigade is paramount, again. And I think it's their last really great contribution to Union victory. We can honestly say here in Wisconsin that without any contradiction, that the Iron Brigade saved this republic. They weren't the only ones that did it, but without them, I don't see the Battle of Gettysburg being won. And it was a battle where the Confederates, if they won another great victory, might win the entire war. The Eastern Army of the Potomac had been whipped in battle after battle. They were kind of like 0 for 3 in the last battles, and their confidence level was low. And the Confederate Army under Lee was so... This is about the time when their strength was their best. They were extremely confident. They got way into southern Pennsylvania, 8 miles across the Maryland border, to this little town, a crossroads town at Gettysburg. And some cavalry under General Buford had been holding up the Confederates. A New York brigade commanded by Lysander Cutler, who I might have mentioned at Bronner Farm, is now commanding this New York brigade that they're going to argue with in the 1880s. He himself is originally from New York, but had moved to Wisconsin. But he's there. But they get torn up by the initial Confederate onslaught. And as somebody in the 56th Pennsylvania and Cutler's brigade admitted to the Iron Brigade, as a matter of fact, we ran like sheep. And onto that situation comes the Iron Brigade. Naturally, they send the 2nd Wisconsin in first, into some woods called McPherson's Woods. There's a brigade of Tennesseans in there. It's 10:30 in the morning. And General Reynolds, who commands a whole wing of the Army of the Potomac for General Meade, the new commander, the last thing he'll say in this earth is to tell the 2nd Wisconsin, get those fellows out of those woods. And they line up and they are loading their muskets on the run. They haven't stopped running. They have to get to this battle before the high ground beyond town is taken by the rebels. Reynolds' strategy is to fight a fighting withdrawal on that first day of Gettysburg until the rest of the Union Army can come up and occupy the high ground south of the town, beyond the town. And so these guys are, can I say this? They're sacrificial lambs. But they're not going to act that way. They are going to do something awesome on July 1st, 1863, that the nation largely ignored. And what they do is bigger than Bronner Farm. Now they are on the great stage of history for all time. This is it. It's one of those this is it moments, and they know it. Men go in those woods to meet some veteran Tennesseeman, a rifleman. And the Tennessee boys have seen them before. And they say, it's them damn black hat fellers. And they're swearing and cussing. They let out a huge volley on the 2nd Wisconsin, 2 different regiments on 1 Union regiment. And about 120 10 men or more of that 302 men that went into those woods go down on the very first series of shots, that within a split second. Their colonel, Lucius Fairchild, who is a firm anti-slavery Wisconsin guy, an incredible Union man, is shot in the arm and has to be taken from the field. Reynolds goes down. Some of his officers go down. Now, to the shock of General Archer's brigade, which is mostly Tennesseans who are veterans, that volley that has so staggered the 2nd Wisconsin doesn't stop them. Any other regiment would have just ran. When one-third of your guys go down in a split second, I think you're losing. If you know better, you'll run. They didn't. They kept coming and reloaded and got off a terrible volley with two-thirds of the remaining 2nd Wisconsin on the Tennessee troops. Then the Tennesseans looked to their right from the woods, and there was the 19th Indiana and the 24th Michigan wrapping around their flank, and they ran down the hill. And you can go through those woods today, and you can walk down, and you can see what a horrible position they would be in if they were flanked. And they ran down across a little creek called Willoughby Run and up onto another hill. And you know what? The 2nd Wisconsin and the other Iron Brigade troops ran after them at the run, and they captured hundreds of them. And they marched those guys through the streets in the late morning of July 1st. That made the Gettysburg citizens think, we must be winning. And the rest of the day, things would not go well that way. But it was the Iron Brigade that had done that. Then they realized, we're way out in front of the whole army that's coming up here. We better pull back to the woods where we were. And they crossed the creek again. Now, normally what you do is you pull those guys out of the fight. They're tired. They've used up all their ammo. Usually they get 40 rounds. They probably use 20 or 30. But they were reprovisioned with rounds. There was a noon lull. And then they fought Tennesseans and whooped them, okay? At the same time, the 6th Wisconsin had fought a group of Mississippians in a railroad cut further to the north, about a quarter mile or half mile north of that position of the 2nd Wisconsin. They had joined with a New York regiment from that other brigade, and they had crossed about 300 yards of pure death. They lost half their men. But Rufus Dawes, who himself was the great-grandson of William Dawes, who rode with Paul Revere. You see why these guys want to fight for the Union? It's personal. In the 19th Indiana, you got the grandson of Alexander Hamilton. This is what you've got. These men know what is at stake. This is not today. It's Americans don't get it. You know, they don't say, why would they fight so much? Who cares about the United States? They cared. They died for this. This abstract idea of liberty. This is not something abstract to them. This is real. Their forebears made this country, and they want to keep it at all costs. What Dawes did, Rufus Dawes did, who had become a colonel, he originally was just a captain. You get promoted when the other guys get killed. And he had never been wounded even in many fights, and he was worried about that. But he sent one part of his regiment, a company, into this big ravine, which is a railroad cut, where the railroad was unfinished, and gave natural cover to the rebels. That's why they lost so many men going across this open ground. It was deadly. I mean, you shouldn't even try it, but they just went and did it. They were ordered to go and try to blunt this other Confederate brigade that had made the other Union brigade that was ahead of them run into the woods up ahead, and they went ahead and got them. But this one move by Dawes, getting a company into the ravine and firing the length of the railroad cut right into the Confederates, turned the tide. And there was this moment where what's left of his regiment and a New York regiment to his left are cocking their muskets and ready to continue the fight and fire a volley, right? And the other guys are ready to fire a volley back. And it's kind of like, well, who has the upper hand? Well, there's that company firing down the length of this ravine. That helps convince the Rebs they're not going to win. The Rebels actually have more guys in that railroad cut by numbers. And you've got a few scattered shots. You have a struggle where a couple of six Wisconsin guys are killed trying to get the flag of the second Mississippi. And then a third big guy goes in there and just gets it. And Dawes is one of many officers who's basically say, surrender or die, or something like that. We've got you. And they agree. And they get a whole bunch of Mississippians captured. The rest go running like sheep the other opposite way. They've been running down the railroad cut, and that threat is over. Now, about 2 o'clock, they fight a brigade of very plucky Virginians who are fresh. They haven't fought yet today on July 1st, and they whoop them and drive them back through the woods again. They're not done yet. They have to reform. The rebels are making their great last effort on July 1st. They are going to have to fight a third time. This is unbelievable. This is incredible. You almost never see this. And they're winning. They win the first fight. They win the second fight. And they have one at the end of the day and before they punch out. And they're in front of a Lutheran theological seminary. With a brigade on either side, they have Battery B, which had always fought with them, right close by. There's a 5th Maine battery that's really stout. Somebody had been working for them to pile up some lumber and trees, you know, to give them some cover. The 24th Michigan really becomes the center of the brigade for this last fight. They earn their spurs finally. If there are any holdouts as to whether they're good, the 24th Michigan loses 9 color bearers. And then Colonel Morrow, who is an unbelievable figure and beloved by the brigade by now, grabs the 24th Michigan's colors and defiantly basically says, we're going to stand or die here. He's letting everybody know we're not going anywhere. And the rest of the brigade forms up on either side of the 24th Michigan. Now, a whole new brigade, mostly of North Carolinians, in another division of Confederate troops that have been brought up. They get to fight, you know, sort of like you get to, it's sort of a sample pack, threesome here, a three for one in a battle. And that's not good, though, because this is deadly serious. And they really whoop them good. They stagger them and drive them back. And then they look, it's 4 o'clock, and then they look to their right, and all the Union troops are running. And they look to their left, and all the Union troops are running because the Confederates have deployed about 6,000 more men than the Union has on the field. And if everybody makes a big long line, the guys with more guys are going to be able to outflank the other army, which is what happens a little before 4 o'clock, depending on whose pocket watch you consult. And the Iron Brigade has the distinction of being the last unit off the field on the first day of fighting at Gettysburg. They are one of the few units that has to be ordered to retreat. They hadn't planned on going anywhere. They looked at all these guys running, and they just stayed. They stood their ground. One 24th Michigan volunteer was badly wounded in the leg and wasn't be taken to the hospital, one of the buildings on campus of the seminary, to basically have to be attended to later. And he was biting cartridges and passing them up to his comrades so they could fire faster. I mean, that was going on all along the line. You couldn't put this into a movie because no one would believe it.
Thomas Martin Sobotky is the voice of our Civil War series, Iron Brigade and Beyond. He's a historian, teacher, and the author of the book, Across That Dark River, The Civil War Memory, published by Moving Train Books. He's published articles for North and South Magazine, including an upcoming one on war correspondence, and he lives in Pewaukee. Our Civil War series is produced by Stephanie Lecce. You can see historical photographs and find the rest of the series installments at wuwm.com/lake effect. One last break, and then we'll learn about the continuing success of the Milwaukee Winter Farmers Market as Lake Effect continues on WUWM.
Oh. comrades brave around me lying. Filled with thoughts of home and God.